Summer House by Rageproof Rock, read by Potvic Lover. The day the McKays moved into Eureka, Jack got approximately a dozen phone calls from Fargo, who was hiding under a desk in his office at Global Dynamics. "Do you know the last time I saw Rodney McKay?" Fargo whispered through the telephone line. "I last saw Rodney McKay when he was threatening to kill me, using a protractor during a seminar he was leading in graduate school. This was before he started to lose his hair. Can you just imagine what a safety threat he is by now?"
"I see," Jack said sympathetically. "He might have graduated to using a compass by now."
"You! Oh my God! I think I can hear him coming down the hall! Send help!"
Fargo whispered, terrified, and hung up with a long, solid beep. Jack was still rolling his eyes and tucking away his phone when Vincent walked over to top off his coffee. "I swear to God," Jack sighed, wrapping his hand around the mug, "I think Fargo gets crazier every day." "It's the pressure," Vincent said sympathetically. "And it probably doesn't help that rumor has it Rodney McKay's moving into town." "Okay," Jack said, setting down his mug and frowning. "Now I'm curious." "No," was the first thing Jack heard when he got out of the car, parked in front of an enormous three-story Victorian mansion on the edge of town, on the lake where the trees were thick and there was almost no traffic. "Why not? I checked. It's not against the neighborhood guidelines," came the answering whine. "Come on, you wouldn't let me have one back on Atlantis." "Right, because you desperately needed a helipad on a city surrounded by water. And you promised we could get one if I agreed to move to Freakwell with you." The voice finished resolutely. "It's either that or you let me pick up water skiing." Nobody answered when Jack knocked on the enormous double doors. So he walked around the side of the house, along the wraparound porch, until he saw two men standing on the back steps, looking disheveled and out of breath, surrounded by boxes marked things like "Dangerous" and "Really, really dangerous" and "Legos." "Gentlemen," Jack said, and they both turned around to stare at him. He wished he had a hat he could tip at them or something. "Hey, sorry to interrupt." "No problem at all," the dark-haired one said smoothly, smiling and taking a few slow, slightly uneven steps forward, with an outstretched arm to catch Jack in a handshake. "John Shepherd." Jack smiled and said, "Nice to meet you, John. I'm Jack Carter, the local sheriff." John gave the other man a dirty look. "Congratulations. We've been in town less than a day, and somebody already called the sheriff on you," he said accusingly. And turning back to Jack, he said, "I'm sorry, but in Rodney's defense, I think at least some of the accusations made against him are exaggerated." Jack raised his brows at the blonde one, cheeks spotted red in what appeared to be a combination of impotent rage and embarrassment. "Let me guess," Jack said. "Rodney McKay?" Rolling his eyes, Rodney said, "Yes, in the flesh. What scurrilous lies have people been telling you about me?" John's expression was part indulgent amusement and part curiosity. "Nothing specific," Jack admitted. "But I've gotten at least a dozen calls this morning from Douglas Fargo, claiming you're out to eat his soul." John made a noise that sounded suspiciously like cracking up, and Rodney gave him a look that could have killed a man, before grinding out, "Douglas Fargo is as much a hopeless waste of oxygen today as he was when he was TAing for my intro physics class at Berkeley and almost put out my eye trying to show undergraduates how to use the right hand rule." "I'll just go inside and put on some coffee," John volunteered, and walked into the house through the back door, limping slightly, and Jack tracked his motions until Rodney started snapping urgently in his face, saying, "Hey, hey, eyes up front and center, buddy!" "Hey," Jack said, putting up his hands in a universal peacekeeping gesture. "No encroachment intended. It's just that he was limping." And as soon as Jack said it, Rodney's face got tight and fierce and a little cold, and Rodney nodded and said, "War injury, and you might as well come in. He's going to sulk about me being antisocial if you don't stay and talk for a while." "Do all newcomers warrant a visit from the sheriff, or is Rodney just special?" John asked, blowing across his mug of coffee while Rodney fussed at the movers, who all looked suspiciously like Marines, in the living room, shouting things like, "No, not there, you idiot," and "Oh my God, look, I know for a fact not all jarheads are this stupid," while John appeared serene and unconcerned. "It's a small, small, strange town," Jack said easily. "You're the first new people to have moved in since I got here." He waited a beat. "You're not worried there, you know, going to kill him?" John smirked, eyes flickering towards the doorway to the other room. Rodney's bark is much worse than his bite, and he's saved their asses dozens of times, he said demurely. They know that.
Sir!
Came a strangled cry from the other room. I'm seriously considering killing Dr. McKay! Find your Zen place, Lieutenant, John yelled back. Consider this on the ground officer training. Jack grinned. Do I want to know? He asked. Not really, John admitted, and setting down his mug, he leaned forward across the kitchen counter and said, Hey, so, in the moving materials, nobody said much about what to do in this town aside from have an IQ of 160 and higher, and I was wondering. Jack made a pained expression. That bad? John said sadly. Worse, Jack muttered. I finally cobbled together a baseball league, and they digitized the sport. They wouldn't even let us use real balls in case anybody got a head injury. Jack and John shared a long, pained sigh, cut short when Rodney barreled back into the room, holding a battered pair of Air Force Academy sweatpants, and shaking them in John's face. What are these? He demanded. I've thrown these away 3 separate times. By noon the next day, the entire town was talking about Rodney McKay, and most of the gossip filtered in through Vincent's. So out of totally professional curiosity, Jack brought his mountain of paperwork in and camped at the counter, eavesdropping like crazy. Taggart heard from Beverly at the market, who heard from one of the kids who came in to see her for weekly sessions, that Rodney McKay had once blown up 3/4 of a solar system, had a brain that rivaled Nathan Stark's, had kidnapped a male model on his way into town. He's actually there of his own free will, Jack had interrupted, and also that he'd only agreed to work in Eureka in exchange for the total focus of some of the greatest minds in Global Dynamics medical research labs. All of it's totally true, Taggart insisted. God's honest. Jack rolled his eyes and filled in another E-34-1B form, accidental launch of a small non-ballistic missile without the injury rider, and said, Well, that solar system thing has to be made up. And after the initial rush of gossip died down, stories started filtering in. It turned out almost every serious brain in Eureka had a one-time Rodney McKay story. Henry had about a dozen. I mean, he kept Area 51 from being boring, that's for sure, Henry mused over lunch, picking at the last of his egg-fried rice while Vincent had listened, rapt. Don't even get me started on the time somebody accidentally wiped his game of Sims. So, what's the deal with John Shepard, anyway? Jack asked, trying not to think about Area 51, or aliens, or any number of disturbing allusions that had been made to space travel and extraterrestrials since Rodney had moved into town. Fargo rushed into the diner, shaking and looking on the verge of a nervous breakdown. I need 3 coffees to go, 1 for me and 2 for Satan. He glanced at Jack and Henry balefully. He's making me engineer his boyfriend a helicopter with a force field around it, he said poisonously, and ran out of the diner again as soon as the coffees appeared. Henry looked thoughtful. I guess that sort of explains it, he said awkwardly. Watch, Jack said grimly. Zoe will decide she's madly in love with him now.
I'm madly in love with him, Zoe sighed later, dreamily staring out of the window of the SUV at the sidewalk in front of Eureka's only school, where John was standing and chatting with the principal. They say he technically is a kindergarten teacher, but that he'll be picking up a few of the higher-level math classes.
Jack rolled his eyes. Are you even in any of the higher-level math classes? He asked, deciding to keep the taken and gay and crazy, crazy boyfriend cards for later, when he needed true satisfaction as a parent. Zoe glared at him. I could be, she said defensively. Yeah, you and what microchip? Jack muttered, and stepped on the gas. The first time Jack saw McKay at work was 3 weeks later, when he was following Allison around Global Dynamics, trying to get her to explain to him what exactly was that unidentified thing that had been flying around the town for the last 3 days, and followed her right into the medical research ward, where Rodney was throwing what could generously be called a tantrum. When I agreed to sign on for your scientific Stepford, I was promised the full and undivided attention of your staff until such time the issue was resolved, Rodney snarled, and 3 of the researchers in the room actually tried to hide behind Nathan Stark, who at least was standing his ground. "You know what your problem is, Rodney?" Nathan started calmly. "You?" Rodney spat out. "Your incompetence?"
"You're too impatient," Nathan said soothingly. "I'm a man of my word, and when I said we were devoting our resources, I meant it. But even genius needs time."
"Time?" Rodney ground out. "I have. Time for mistakes? I don't. If anything like what happened today ever goes down again, the deal's off. Do you understand?"
Stark rolled his eyes. "I see you haven't grown out of your dramatics."
"No, I've grown into them," Rodney snapped back. "And you can put up a brave front as much as you'd like. You need me here. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'll be taking the rest of the day off to go home and to make sure he doesn't bleed to death on our floor," he finished, and stormed right out of the room, past Allison and past Jack, who parted to make way for his warpath.
"Nathan," Allison said, clearly amused. "I don't want to talk about it," Stark growled, and turned on the researchers, saying, "What the hell were you thinking?"
"God," Jack said later, tackling a long gnome with a fission-based propulsion pack on. "I really hate this town."
After a while, things normalized, and John and Rodney just turned into another odd fixture in Eureka, the handyman slash kindergarten teacher, and the town's latest resident genius, who was frequently seen entering and exiting Vincent's cafe covered in what looked a lot like tar.
"What the hell?"
Jack asked once, and Vincent had only smirked and said, "Let's just say he's kind of whipped." 3 days later, Jack got a call from John, saying that if he saw an unidentified but totally cool object zipping around the skies of Eureka, not to bother trying to tackle it, since it was just John and his insanely awesome new helicopter. "I'm never going to understand this place," Jack said later, over dinner to Zoe, who was face down at the table, despite Sarah's worried maternal noises, which sounded a lot like a dial-up modem with better harmonics.
"I can't even deal today,"
Zoe muttered into the wood.
"Mr. Shepard's gay. My whole life is a festering pit."
When baseball season started, John volunteered immediately, but said regretfully that given the current state of his leg, he was only going to be able to manage the catcher's position.
"You shouldn't be managing any position," Rodney wailed from the bleachers. "Oh my God, what are you doing? You still have to do physical therapy, and you want to chase balls."
"Have you ever thought about having him see a professional?" Jack wondered out loud between innings. "I don't know," John said speculatively, pulling off his catcher's mask and tucking it under one arm to brush his sweaty bangs out of his face, a move which inspired Zoe to clutch feverishly at the chain-link fence that separated her from making her romantic approach. "I kinda like him this way."
"Yeah," Jack said, smirking. "You seem to."
"And they got the bullet out," John continued, grinning, "so I know it's not just the lead poisoning talking." Which was about the time Rodney started throwing homemade Gatorade at them, yelling for John to keep hydrated, to watch his electrolytes, to stop bending over like that, because some of the female engineers in the stands were beginning to look dangerously like they were ready to actually talk to a man face to face.
"I can see why," Jack said earnestly, while John purposefully dropped a quarter and took a small geologic error to pick it up, while Rodney sputtered in the background. "He's amazingly charming."
A few months after that, the town meeting was appended with a note from John, smilingly inviting everybody over for a Super Bowl party. He promised there'd be copious beer and buffalo wings, and at the lack of RSVPs other than Jack's and Thust,
"Hell yeah," John had sighed and said, "Oh, and Rodney's also hosting a robotics race the same day," which had elicited a lot more agreement.
"Eureka," John had said when he opened the door, wearing a pink Kiss the Chef apron. "Eureka," Jack had agreed, holding up a six-pack and holding back his daughter, who had almost, but not quite, worked through her tragic love for John, who apparently had six-year-olds proposing to him day in and day out.
"Hi, Mr. Shepherd," Zoe said fatuously.
John smiled at her warmly. "Hey, Zoe, did you do something to your hair?" She touched her green braids self-consciously.
Yeah, you know, just yesterday. Well, it's great, John told her, and waved them into the house. Very mossy. Zoe turned a nearly supernatural color red, and she squeaked, "Thank you," even as John said, "Hey, all the people under 30 are upstairs with a PlayStation, if you felt like joining them." "She's a nice kid," John said, as she shot up the stairs, and Jack rolled his eyes. "Now," John said, rubbing his hands together, "I've got all the geeks corralled onto the side yard to race robots. I think you and I have an appointment with a football game." And when Jack saw the TV, it wasn't really a TV as much as a wall of such incredibly beautiful high definition that he nearly started to cry, he said, "God bless you, Shepard." "I know," John agreed. "It was emotional for me, too." "Okay, this is kind of emotional for me, too," John said, sitting at the counter in Jack's kitchen and smiling soppily at the walls. "It's been a long time since my house talked back to me." Jack tried not to think too hard, but couldn't help it. "You lived in a talking house, too?" "Well, talking city," John amended, and beamed when Sarah said, "Your beer is ready, John." He plucked it from the fridge and said, "Why, thank you, Sarah. You're a doll." All the lights warmed for a moment in pleasure, and Jack muttered, "Floozy." John spent the whole rest of the night cracking up when the sink sputtered water all over Jack, or the beer soaked him, or the chair tipped him off the cushion, all while UNC played Duke at Cameron in the background, 78-76, with coaches breaking clipboards on both sides of the court. "So, you're clearly still new at this talking house thing," John said, delighted. Feet kicked up on the coffee table. Jack growled. "Little help here, Casanova?" John just lipped his beer. "No, thanks. Atlantis can tell when I come home, smelling like differently recycled air." "I don't even want to know," Jack muttered, and got tipped onto the floor again. Exactly 18 months after the moving trucks had been rolling into town, a small caravan of black SUVs rode into Eureka, making a beeline for the McKay property, and by lunch, Vincent was earnestly redistributing all the dependably corroborated information he had. "It was definitely military. At least two people are voting for Air Force, based on the uniforms, and all of them looked kind of pissed," Vincent said, businesslike to a small and nervous crowd. "As far as Tori can tell from the other shore of the lake, with her telescope and the long-range mics, it sounds like McKay's being recalled to wherever he was before he came to Eureka." "Wait," said somebody in the crowd, alarmed. "Does that mean they're actually leaving?" "Well, McKay might," said another voice, "but Shepard's treatment's still only half completed at best. It'll be months more before we can even tell if it's had any permanent therapeutic effect." Vincent and Jack shared a look. "Then I guess they're not leaving," Vincent said. "Really?" Fargo asked, sounding crushed. "I mean, really?" "I don't know if you've noticed this," Jack said conspiratorially. "But McKay's kind of whipped." Exactly 18 months and a day after the SUVs rode into Eureka, they rolled back out again, Rodney determinedly standing on his front porch and glaring at their fading taillights. "You know, I think Fargo's turning into an alcoholic," Jack said conversationally the next morning, when Rodney breezed into the diner for his usual breakfast of a pot of coffee, two eggs, a waffle, and some insistent shouting into his cell phone. Rodney snorted, "Well, tell him we are blowing this popsicle stand just as soon as John's fit to pass their draconian medical exams." Then, knocking on the counter, he said, "Hurry, hurry, hurry! I have a serious suspicion that Zach's been taking advantage of the fact that I'm always predictably 5 minutes late waiting for my breakfast to start sabotaging my priceless work." "I'll pass along the message," Jack said, and turned back to his newspaper. It was the dead of winter when John and Rodney finally did blow out of Eureka, although they left with considerably less than they'd come with, stopping off at the diner for one last meal before driving out of town to God knows where with only John's cherry red Mustang. "Penis extension," Rodney snapped, and two duffel bags thrown in the back. "So, are you sending more long-suffering Marines to come get the rest of your stuff later?" Jack asked when Rodney slipped off for one last shouting match via the cell phone in the back of the diner. John grinned at him over the coffee. Don't let this get around, but Rodney actually likes it here. Jack turned to glance at Rodney, kicking a wall, while Vincent looked on, distressed. That's so? He's a subtle, subtle man, John said, totally deadpan. We're leaving most of the stuff at the house, because even if he doesn't, I kind of like it here. He grinned. We get about 2 months leave a year. We'll be back. You should time it, Jack said, too casually, to line up with certain sports events. Trust me, John said seriously. It's a date. Excuse me? Rodney said, stomping back up to the table and giving Jack a thoroughly unamused glare. I thought I told you about eyes front and center, Sheriff. Jack smirked. Yes, you did. My eternal apologies. Rodney sniffed, affronted, and John, laughing, got up and tucked his coat back on over his dress blues that had been distracting the entire diner, and taking Rodney by the elbow, saying, Come on, we'd better head out. And when he left, waving, he wasn't limping at all. Zoe spent most of the rest of the week devastated, lying on the floor, reading Dylan Thomas, listening to some band called Bright Eyes. She dyed her hair black, and Jack figured that was at least a win in the natural hair color, even if it's not her natural hair color category. Do you really think they'll be back? She asked sadly. John said he'd liked it here, Jack said confidently, sipping his morning coffee. I mean, will his crazy, crazy boyfriend let him come back? She sniped. Jack grinned into his mug, thinking about being invited in for coffee, and the helipad he'd seen in the backyard, and the force field helicopter, and, earlier that year, the water skis John had been talking about buying, while Rodney had shuffled food into his mouth depressively. Yeah, Jack said, he's kind of whipped. The End. Shoreleaf by Rageproof Rock. Read by Potvig Lover. Eureka was in the throes of its longest recorded Indian summer, when a black Maserati Grand Sport, with a Nero Incrociator grill and 19-inch polished rims, roared into town, slowing to a purring stop in front of Cafe Diem. It was low to the ground, and the engine was making continuously sweet, rolling noises, idling on Eureka's specially designed non-heat-retaining asphalt. And when Rodney McKay tumbled awkwardly out of the passenger side door, rushing into the diner to order up the largest coffee Vincent made. It was basically a beer stain with a lid. Nobody was surprised. Welcome back, Jack said sarcastically. Rodney turned 6 shades of red and snatched the coffee out of Vincent's numb fingers and muttered, I don't want to talk about it, before scrambling out of the cafe again and back into the car. In the year and a half since McKay and John had coasted out of town in John's Mustang, there had been 3 minor crises involving guided missiles, all confined thankfully to 1 week, an incident with some faulty cloning, and that one time somebody accidentally discovered the world's strongest epoxy in one of the chemistry classes at the high school, and everybody was literally stuck for nearly a day. All in all, new day, same shenanigans in Eureka, which made Rodney and John's return the biggest news, since Nathan Stark got covered in inhibition-reducing cologne and spent about an hour hitting on Jack through the walls of a containment chamber while Fargo had looked on in horrified fascination. Here to forage for gossip for the township? Rodney said instead of hello when he opened the door to the house. At Jack's raised eyebrow, he mumbled, Come in. It's good seeing you too, McKay, Jack said sweetly, and under his breath he asked, How's the slack? Rodney's expression cleared, and his mouth twitched in an expression that was almost pleasant. It's good. He's doing good. I can hear you guys, you know, John said from where he was hunched over the kitchen counter, eyes focused intently on an opened file, flanked on either side by a small mountain of paperwork. He looked up and grinned. Jack, long time no see. John, Jack said, nice car. Isn't it? John practically purred, like his Maserati, and looked meaningfully at Rodney, who took the opportunity to mutter, Oh God, under his breath, and beat it out of the kitchen, presumably to contemplate his shame at having a kept man, and hide in the basement. Their third day in Eureka, John invited Jack over for the BC game, and they spent most of the night becoming more and more riotously drunk, until they were reduced to slumping on the floor of the living room, pointing dimly at the television.
"This is horrible," Jack slurred during the fourth quarter.
"I know," John mourned. "McKay's going to kill me when he gets back from his date."
It took almost a full minute for the sentence to parse, but when it did, Jack said,
"What?"
And John's only response was to pass out where he lay on the rug, face half mashed into the universal remote, so that the television started streaming madcap through hundreds and hundreds of channels. Jack woke up the next morning to an utterly furious Zoe, holding a spray bottle filled with water between his eyes.
"Gah!"
he shouted, rolling off his bed and landing with a painful thump while she looked on impassively.
"About time," she snapped. "I swear to God, Dad, I never have been so embarrassed in my life."
Jack rubbed his temples.
"What happened?"
he asked miserably, trying to gather up an ability to recall anything other than the seemingly endless supply of Molsons at McKay's house, and how John had always had one to pass over to Jack as soon as his was empty.
"I'll tell you what happened," Zoe shouted, totally disregarding Jack's pounding head. "Dr. McKay had to practically carry you into the house. Sarah thought you were dying. She spent most of the night waking me up to report your breathalyzer results."
Zoe narrowed her eyes. 0.98, by the way, if you're interested. Jack stared at the ceiling for a long moment.
"And let us use this as a perfect opportunity to discuss why alcohol is not your friend," he tried.
"Oh my God," Zoe muttered. "Forget it, I'm going to school."
Joe was about as sympathetic as Zoe, which meant not at all, and she'd taken special care to turn up the sound of Jack's walkie-talkie before he reached the office, so the first 911 of the day was nearly enough to make Jack crawl under his desk and pray for sweet death. Jack gave himself the rest of the afternoon off, barring any explosions with a blast radius of more than a city block, and put his head down on the counter at Vincent's cafe, while Vince made soothing, clucking noises and poured him coffee.
"You two are a hazard," Jack heard Vincent say, and glanced up blurrily to see John slumped over next to him on the counter.
"I haven't felt this awful since my first leave,"
John muttered into a pile of napkins under his face. Jack mumbled something into his arm, and the entire evening came crashing back into his brain, which left him vulnerable to blurting out, "Wait, did you say McKay was on a date last night?"
"God,"
John moaned into the counter.
"Don't remind me. He nearly throttled me on the living room floor when he got back."
A beat.
"Like it's my fault Sam Carter won't sleep with him."
John, oblivious to the fact that activity had all but screeched to a halt in the cafe, made another pitiful noise into the napkins and said,
"Vincent, can I have that coffee with cream and cyanide?"
Jack had spent at least a decade in a house where he was outnumbered by women, so he had some idea of the type of disdain you could attract if you wronged the sisterhood. But nothing could have really prepared him for the level of unabashed, prurient interest that hit the fan the next day. Beverly, the Baker twins, Deacon, Allison, and Vincent were huddled together whispering furiously, and every once in a while Jack overheard something like, "Bastard," and "I'd kill him." "Should you guys even be talking about this?" Jack asked desperately. He felt somewhat responsible, having been coerced by Vincent's threat of being denied coffee henceforward at Diem, into telling the whole and unvarnished truth. He may have perhaps said some unflattering things of an editorial nature about McKay buying John's silence and suffering with increasingly sexy cars, which, to be honest, Jack wouldn't be averse to. Beverly and the Baker twins executed a perfect about-face to narrow their eyes at him, and Jack muttered and turned back to his lunch plate, saying under his breath, "I'm just saying." "Small towns live on gossip, Jack," Allison said, grinning.
"Yes," Jack said wryly, "I'm beginning to see that."
The situation continued to deteriorate until Jack found himself in the grocery store one night on the way home, only to overhear Rodney McKay making a series of deeply baffled noises as Beverly dropped completely unsubtle hints about the destructive nature of infidelity.
"What the hell are you talking about?"
Rodney demanded, nearing stratospheric fury. Beverly sighed at him. "I'm just saying, Dr. McKay, that affairs are usually a sign of some more deeply seated issue, and that you'll feel far more fulfilled by talking with John about it than by..."
"Oh, my God!"
Rodney said in horror, and Jack could practically hear the widening of his eyes. "You think, Colonel Shepherd and I... Oh, my God!" Despite the fact that their entrances and exits always made a big splash, the McKays... Oh, God, Jack thought to himself miserably, I have to stop calling them that, were usually quiet and kept to themselves, which made the call from the next house over all the more frightening. The fact that the shouting was loud enough to be heard from the next house over must have been very disturbing, but Jack bet that it was nothing compared to standing on the front porch with Joe and listening to every word, crystal clear through the ancient clapboard walls.
"Do you know what this entire fucking town? Well, maybe you should stop cheating on me."
Jack and Joe winced at one another. "I'll flip you for it," Jack offered. "Not a chance in hell," Joe said. Jack sighed and knocked on the door, not at all subtly praying nobody would answer. He got his wish, but it came with an abundance of crashing noises from inside, which was the point where he and Joe looked at one another with a sigh and tried the knob. The door came open easily.
"Oh, my God! Oh, my God!"
Rodney was shrieking, audibly higher pitched than before, and clearly unaware that the law had been called.
"Are you even hearing what you're saying out loud? Have you completely forgotten what don't ask, don't tell is?"
Joe and Jack shared a look and followed the voices into the kitchen, where Jack could see a shattered coffee mug on the floor. "Always a good sign," he thought morosely. "Maybe you should say something," Jack told Joe, who only glared back.
"What?"
he hissed.
"Are you completely oblivious?"
John yelled from the other room.
"I live with you. We own real estate. You tried to throw away my favorite pants. The only person in the entire goddamn military-industrial complex that doesn't think we're together is you."
Joe glared at Jack meaningfully, mouthing hugely, "Do something." Jack mouthed back, "Oh my God, what?" And Joe gave the long-suffering sort of sigh that meant she hated him, and said, loudly but firmly,
"Dr. McKay, Colonel Shepherd."
There was a long, awkward pause before they heard Rodney clear his throat and say,
"Yes?"
Joe punched Jack in the arm.
"Ow!
Sorry to interrupt, but we got a call in from your neighbors about the noise." He winced at the continued, overwhelming, uncomfortable silence. Everything all right in there?" And finally John poked his head out of the kitchen doorway and sighed, looking at once embarrassed and relieved for the break in hostilities.
"Yeah, we are fine," he offered up a tight, rueful smile.
"Sorry about the noise complaints." "It's fine," Jack said soothingly, because the broken mug was still on the floor, and this, like so many fights with his ex-wife had gone, could still get ugly real fast. Then Rodney stuck his head out of the doorway, face red and blotchy and eyes feverish.
"Okay, I have to ask this," he asked too quickly. "Do you think we are, you know, together?"
He flicked his fingers between John and himself for just a second, before John rolled his eyes and muttered,
"Oh, Jesus,"
and turned to leave.
"What?"
Rodney called after him.
"What?"
"We should probably go," Jack said, trying not to fling himself back out of the door.
"But yes,"
Joe said, looking at Rodney intensely with the glare all the women in town must have practiced together, because it looked exactly like Allison's and Beverly's and even Kim's.
"We did," she said dangerously.
Rodney got even more red, if possible.
"I see,"
he squeaked.
"Yeah, we are leaving," Jack said, grabbing Joe by the arm and holding her out of the house,
because he saw the direction this entire situation was going, and it was headed toward a whole different kind of noise complaint. By the next morning, news of the evening's fight had travelled far and wide throughout Eureka, and even those not privy to the innermost and juiciest gossip were whispering about trouble in paradise. Jack was keeping his mouth resolutely shut on the entire affair, and Joe seemed to have blocked it out entirely. But despite his best efforts, Jack didn't manage to keep all the information rooted away from Zoe, who returned from school nearly effervescent with excitement, babbling about her plans for her romantic approach to a vulnerable but still loving John. Jack sometimes wondered if letting her live here was the best idea, since the closest approximation Zoe had now to a mother figure was Sarah, who had a disturbing possessiveness about her. "I'm pretty sure it's not going to work out, Zoe," Jack tried a few days later. She narrowed her eyes at him. "Dad, this could be the love of my life," she told him severely. "He's like 3 decades older than you," Jack protested. "He's like my age. Do you want to be dating somebody my age? He could be your dad." "Okay, ooh," Zoe snapped. "Love knows no age, Dad." "Yeah, whatever," Jack muttered under his breath, cupping his hands around his second coffee of the morning. And when Zoe flounced out of the house, Jack turned to the walls and said, "I swear to God, Sarah, isn't there anything we can do about her?" "I'm not certain this would be the most preferable avenue," Sarah replied harmonically, "but I'm fully fitted with the capability to provide electroshock therapy." And then it was like John and Rodney disappeared for a solid week. No shadow of them in the cafe or the grocery store, the gas station or the movie rental place, the tiny revolving library that had gotten used to the way John burned through trashy John Grisham and French tragedy. "Do you think they're, you know, splitting up?" Taggart asked, sounding overly concerned. "They really shouldn't give up so easily," Kim said, smiling slyly over the table at Deacon. "Please, based on the empirical evidence, McKay's been stepping out for years," Vincent said, frowning. "There's trying, and then there's doormat." They all turned to stare at Jack, who'd been trying to hide behind his newspaper. "What do you think?" Vincent asked him intensely. Jack wanted to say, "Honestly, guys, I think that McKay finally got a clue, and they've spent the past week doing things that I absolutely, positively never want to think about, ever." Out loud, he said, "You know, I couldn't say," and they all turned away, disgusted. On the next Saturday, when the Longhorns were gearing up to defend their championship title, John called and said, "Hey, want to come up and watch the game?" Jack tried to telegraph his wariness over the phone. "Sure," he said, "if you two are done fighting." John laughed, and it was light and warm over the line. "I think we've got it out of our systems," he said mischievously. "Oh, my God," Jack said in agony. "Please tell me you didn't get it out of your systems anywhere I have to sit on if I go over to watch the game." The muffled hysterics on the phone weren't comforting, nor was the distant sound of Rodney's voice yelling, "Hey, hey, who are you laughing with? Is it the sheriff? I thought I told him eyes front and center. Are you inviting him over? You're totally inviting him over. Oh, my God, I hate you so much." Jack sat on the floor for the Longhorns game, and John rolled his eyes copiously, but they both eventually spent most of the game bonding over A, how much they hated the Longhorns, and B, discussing seriously a suicide pact if they won both the football and the basketball NCAA championships. At halftime, McKay wandered into the room, completely distracted by what looked like an incomprehensible academic journal, and hefting a toolbox. He paused just long enough to flash John a totally besotted look. "Whipped," Jack thought. "Totally, totally whipped." And glare at Jack. "Crazy," Jack thought. "Totally, totally crazy, too." And went out back toward the helipad. "What's he doing?" Jack asked as the back door swung shut. John shrugged, eyes focused on the projection screen. "I find it safer not to ask. There's a limited number of laws of physics he can break while stuck on Earth." Jack's jaw clenched. "Please, stop talking about aliens." John smirked at him. "Fine, fine," he acquiesced, and they both turned back to the game. The following day, when Jack got no fewer than 10 hysterical calls from Fargo, claiming Rodney came out of thin air, Jack put his own call in to John, who answered gleefully, "The helicopter now goes invisible." "God," Jack said in disgust, and hung up on him. "Let me guess, new car?" Joe asked from across the room, smile tugging at the corners of her mouth. Rolling his eyes, Jack said, "Invisible helicopter." And when Joe muttered, "McKay is so whipped," Jack started laughing and couldn't stop. The end. Sabbatical by Rage Proof Rock. Read by Potvick Lover. After Kim dies and Eureka gets rewound 4 years, Jack's understandably depressed and spends a lot of time sitting around the house in his boxes, while Sarah and Zoe have concerned whispered conversations about him in other rooms. In a sign that despite teen rebellion she really does love him, Zoe sits down next to him at the beginning of the World Series, looking grim. Before Jack can say something like, "Wow, you really want to watch the series with me?" or "I never really meant all those jokes about the bassinets being switched at the hospital," Zoe holds up a quelling hand and says, "I'm here to support you in your time of middle-aged distress, but I do not want to talk about it." Jack thinks, "Fair enough," and lets her have a beer to dull the pain. And for weeks and weeks after Kim's death, it's like the town is in mourning itself, and very little happens, as the moment of silence stretches out across the span of months. Henry spends a lot of time locked into his garage, and everybody's careful not to have any car accident, lest they disturb him. Even Fargo has left his speed dial 4, Jack's office number, untouched. So it's fair to say that Jack's a little bit surprised to find John Shepherd in the frozen food aisle of the grocery store one totally unremarkable Sunday night, pricing 2 brands of lima beans. "John?" Jack asks, hoping he sounds less stupid than he feels. "Hey, Jack," John says, looking up from his grocery cart, near overflowing. Jack raises his eyebrow at the conspicuous lack of the McKay beer staple and says, "I'm surprised. Usually you spend some time flashing a sexy car and making every guy in town jealous before you bother to stock the pantry." Grinning, John drops one of the bags of lemurs into his cart, saying, "We just got in earlier today, and we came in kind of under the radar this time. Rodney's not working, so I'm guessing your standard Fargo detector didn't alert you to our presence. McKay's seriously going to make him piss himself one day," Jack warns. "That's probably on purpose," John admits, and says, "Hey, look, we're trying to keep a low profile this time around, but I'd like it if you came over to catch the rest of the series with me." Jack smiles and doesn't ask any question. He'll figure it out later. "My daughter thanks you." "Yeah, and McKay thanks you," John snorts. You'd think that a man that obsessed with science would see the mathematical beauty of baseball. "Philistine," Jack agrees, and they go their separate ways. When Jack shows up the next day, John tells him to let himself in, and Jack wanders into the kitchen to find Shepherd fighting a losing war with a crockpot. He slides onto one of the kitchen stools, catching John's eye. "Hello." "Dare I ask? When I was a kid, every time I got sick, my mom made the most amazing soups," John says stubbornly, jabbing a wooden spoon violently in the body of the crockpot. "I have a master's degree. This should be easy." "I said that about parenthood," Jack offers in solidarity. "Parenthood and soup are totally different," John argues. "Oh my God," interrupts the unmistakable sound of Dr. McKay. "I really thought the time I caught you two discussing whether Back to the Future 1 or 3 was the best was scraping the bottom of the barrel, but I see I was too hasty in my judgment." Jack rolls his eyes and says, "Hey, Doc, long time no see." "Yes, well, if the Colonel had any sense of propriety or sensitivity, it would have been even longer," McKay mutters, and Jack sees why, when Rodney wanders into his field of vision, walking delicately into the room, his left arm in a sling and close to his body, his face still dotted with cuts and bruises. He scowls at Jack's expression. Nice, fresh impression, Sheriff Carter.
You're supposed to be in bed, John says, frowning and helping Rodney onto a stool carefully.
Did you cheek that Vicodin I gave you?
Yes, because I'm such a fan of suffering, Rodney snaps, and leans heavily against the counter, peering worriedly into John's crockpot.
What in God's name are you doing?
I'm nursing you, John says sarcastically. Now, are you gonna go back to bed, or are you just going to bitch all the way through the game?
Rodney ends up spending the rest of the evening more or less collapsed against John's shoulder on the couch, and during the second inning, John spreads an afghan across Rodney's lap and absently pats the back of his hand as Rodney slips into sleep, tension rolling out of his body.
What happened? Jack murmurs during a commercial. He can't help but look
at the butterfly bandages on the curve of McKay's cheek, the shadows of bruises on his chin, and the green and purple bruises around his eyes. His wrist is in a cast, and the way he's nearly curled into himself tells Jack that underneath the USAF sweatshirt Rodney's wearing, there are more of the same. He's been beat to hell and wrung out, and McKay looks small and tired and humbled, and Jack doesn't like it at all. John sighs and drops his free hand over his face. I fucked up, he says, and doesn't elaborate.
Apparently, low profile means ghost, and if Jack wasn't spending a lot of evenings at the lake house helping John master the art of making chicken noodle soup,
you realize there's no reason you have to make the noodles from scratch, Jack keeps arguing. He would swear John and Rodney were still off, wherever they were usually off.
Zoe spends a lot of time petitioning to go over too, having moved from nursing a feverish passion for Shepherd to a simmering, hopeless crush of the more manageable kind. When Jack explains to her why not, she doesn't seem to get it, and continues not to get it until the day John asks if Jack will hang out at McKay's sit. He's got an appointment he can't break, despite the amount of yelling John intimates he tried.
He knows what pills to take when, John says, not making eye contact, so it's just a matter of making sure he's awake to take them. I'd just rather not have him waking up in crippling pain.
Understood, Jack says, trying to be casual, despite John's grim expression. And he'll probably be verbally abusive, John adds lightly. He doesn't know I asked you to stay with him.
He looks at where Zoe is staring in mute horror, at the small fortress of orange prescription pills, painkillers and muscle relaxants, anti-anxiety pills and antivirals, antibiotics. Jack can't even imagine what's happened.
You probably shouldn't take anything Rodney says to you to heart, just for the record.
Duly noted, Zoe answers, snapping to attention.
It's a sign of how bad it is that she's not even glancing over the dress blues. John gives them both an uncomfortable smile and says, Thanks, I'll be back in 2 days, in the same uncomfortable way. And Jack and Zoe stand on the porch and wave goodbye, as John drives away in a dark green SUV, taillights fading in the distance.
McKay is uncharacteristically meek when Jack does his first wake up at 8 that night, saying softly,
Hey, McKay, wake up, pill time.
He looks blurry and disoriented just for a second, until his eyes focus on Jack's face and he sighs, reaching out for a segmented pill case on the nightstand.
I should have known he would get me babysitters, Rodney says, neither bitter nor surprised.
I'm here mostly as an alarm clock, Jack tries.
Rodney snorts, but winces, and takes the glass of water Jack offers. Thanks, but he set me on all but 24-hour monitoring since they found me. I kind of anticipated an international inquest wouldn't change that.
For a guy with such a big mouth, McKay makes swallowing look surprisingly painful, and Jack finds himself easing McKay back against the pillows, and Rodney went without a sound, brow furrowed in discomfort, breathing shallowly, asleep again almost instantly. The next morning, Jack's called into town, when a small, relatively small, one of the Baker twins says, Really, the crater is nowhere near as bad as Mrs. Blake is making it sound. Nuclear test goes haywire, so calls home and Zoe comes over, looking wide-eyed and almost a little scared.
What do I do when he wakes up?
She hisses in grey morning light. You give him a glass of water, Jack explains. And if he needs help, help him downstairs. Help him fix breakfast. Zoe's expression is very clear in what she thinks McKay's reaction to her helpfulness will be. Or you could just let him yell at you. You're really good at glazing over in exactly the most infuriating way. Zoe looks thoughtful. That is true, she admits. Jack thinks that putting up a brave face, despite its urge to go totally crackers every time he sees Allison, and crawling through 3 miles of tunnel has earned him a shower. So when he finally gets back to the lake house, it's evening, red and oranges melting across the water. He follows the faint sound of voices around the side of the porch and finds Zoe and McKay sitting at a wicker table, with a small mountain of brown packaging in front of them. Wait, and you like this stuff? Zoe says in horror. McKay sniffs. The MREs have been designed with a balance of nutrition and ease of travel in mind. Okay, ease my ass. It just took us like 20 minutes just to get this one heating. Zoe scoffed. I have a broken wrist, 2 jammed fingers, and 4 broken ribs, and you are incapable of following written instructions. Rodney snapped back, spots of red appearing on his cheeks. The colonel can put one of these together in a snap. Zoe wrinkled her nose at him. No, seriously, is that a sex thing? Because it's really weird you never call him John. Rodney makes a noise that sounds suspiciously like he's choking. Jack decides he can either call time out on the conversation and have the talk with his daughter, since if she's using the word sex, she probably knows how to have it, and that causes him physical pain. Or he can retreat into the kitchen and eavesdrop, while drinking coffee and reading the paper. Cowardice wins, and he tiptoes off. From the kitchen counter, he can see the sights of their faces through the French doors, how Zoe is nearly doubled over in laughter, and how, when making a revolted expression, McKay almost looks healthy. Oh my God, this is so gross! Zoe laughs helplessly, words floating in through the opened window over the sink. I can't even tell what food this is supposed to be! There's a shuffle, and McKay admits, okay, so not all MREs are very gourmet, but they're not terrible. You just don't want to eat whatever it was John left you in the fridge, Zoe says triumphantly. Do you want to eat what we found in the fridge? McKay challenges. I've never seen a food that looked amphibious. There's a long pause before McKay adds, although we should probably stuff it down the garbage disposal before he gets back. An embarrassed beat. So he knows how much I hate it, of course. Woos, Zoe says affectionately. Don't worry, I won't tell anybody. You can be secretly sweet. That's a filthy lie, McKay argues. And if you keep this up, there's no way I'm helping you do your math homework. Jack smiles into his coffee mug. When John finally drags back into Eureka, it's just a few minutes shy of making the trip 3 days instead of 2. He lets himself into the house and thanks Jack for hanging around, and Zoe for distracting McKay, and they both try not to stare too hard at the dark circles under his eyes, or how pale he looks, almost as beat up as McKay when he just got into town. It's not a problem, Jack says smoothly, putting an arm around Zoe's shoulders and squeezing. We were happy to help, Zoe says gently, and that surprises even Jack. Oh, and Rodney totally loved the stew you left him. John looks at her uncertainly. It was a casserole? Was it? Zoe asks, high-pitched. I've only heard about it. He'd eaten all of it before I got a chance. Oh, John says, slightly mollified. Rodney must hear John from upstairs, because there are telltale thumps coming down the stairs that pause halfway down, and McKay's voice, softer than Jack has heard it before, says, John? John turns to glance at the stairs, and Jack and Zoe take the opportunity to let themselves out. And as the door to the house is closing, Jack hears Rodney murmur, Oh, jeez, you look like hell. And John laughing, the rustle of cloth, and John saying, Well, you look much better. Zoe starts making afternoon pilgrimages to the lake house, and comes back looking torn between fury and elation, and Jack wonders if McKay's school of hard love is having a negative effect when he finds Zoe trying to convince Sarah to let her use the house to complete the circuit to model one of her problem sets for class. "It is not that I do not trust you, Zoe," Sarah tells her firmly, "but as much as your intentions may be good, you do not have any idea what you're doing." "But how will I learn if you don't help me?" Zoe asks pitifully. "Carry out your experiments at Dr. McKay's residence, if he's so eager for you to learn by trial," Sarah says snippy, and refocuses in on Jack's presence by saying, "Jack, would you like beer for your cereal or milk today?" Autumn melts into winter, and by the time the first snowfall blankets the town, the McKay's low profile has grown into one of B-rated fame. The sling is gone, and McKay is walking easier, and the worst of the cuts and bruises has healed, even if the pale blue cast, with an X-wing fighter sketched onto it, is still present. Having failed to survive a marriage, and barely surviving the negation of the second, Jack knows that love can in no way conquer all, so he's not surprised when John shows up one evening, looking like he's working on his last thread of sanity, and says, "I'm even willing to watch curling. Just let me in your house, so I don't have to be in mine." "I have satellite," Jack soothes, ushering him into the living room, where Zoe is doing something that looks suspiciously like copying formulas into her TI-89+, instead of learning trigonometry the honest way. "We can watch Japanese baseball." John doesn't say anything, just gives Jack an expression of intense gratitude. "I'm just saying," John admits to beer, and 2 hours later, a TNT run of Bring It On playing in the background, with Zoe repeating all the dialogue along with the TV. "I'm just telling you in advance, I'm starting to get some really violent thoughts, and you should be prepared to get a call about a 419 at the house." Jack quirks one eyebrow. "419? "I've been watching a lot of CSI, John says, eyes crazy. "A lot. It's either that or kill him in his sleep." "I understand," Jack says, giving him another beer. "He sleeps a lot," John emphasizes. "There have been plenty of opportunity." "You should cut him some slack," Zoe calls from her sprawl on the carpet, a half-empty tube of Pringles balanced on her stomach, as she makes duck bills with 2 chips at a time. "He's been eating your stew rolls, hasn't he?" Jack bites his lip, and John looks pained. "I thought I was getting better," he says feebly. "No," Jack and Zoe confirm simultaneously. "Oh," John says, and even his hair looks demoralized. Later that night, they get a call. McKay whispers, frantic and close to the receiver. "I mean, okay, obviously, he's still upset about being a criminally shitty cook, and he'll probably be pouting forever. But there are takeout menus on the fridge now, and his anger is totally directed at you guys. Thank you so, so much." Jack realizes he's been lulled into false sense of security as far as the McKays go when he gets a 911 from the house a week before Christmas. A woman's voice says into the receiver, "I was informed that this number sequence alerts a security team. We require the assistance of a locksmith and a mediator immediately at the home of Rodney McKay and John Shepherd. It's urgent," before she hangs up. Joe, who is listening on the same extension, purses her lips and says, "You go. They like you." "Traitor," Jack says bitterly, and calls Henry as he's walking out of the sheriff's office. Jack and Henry pull up into the white dirt driveway of the house at the same time, and exchange a wary nod when they see that flanking John's green SUV, there are 3 black ones, midnight and sleek and nearly light-absorbing, in their comprehensively dark auras, parked like landmines in front of the house. "She said specifically a locksmith?" Henry says, curious. "Curious is better than wretched," Jack supposes, which might be an upside to all of this. "She said locksmith and mediator, immediately," Jack answers grimly. And as if on cue, the front door bursts open, and a woman in a long leather peasant skirt and clinging purple tunic comes out, hair looking slightly wild and face flushed. "Are you the security team?" she demands, and Jack barely finishes nodding before she says, "Good, you are finally here. Please, hurry. I do not know how much longer John can continue to jam Rodney's cell phone signal." "You said she said locksmith," Henry hisses accusingly. "Don't shoot the messenger, buddy," Jack snaps, and they run up the front steps and the hall steps until they come to the closed door of the master bedroom, where John is sitting on the ground typing frantically on a silvery laptop, shouting all the while, "Rodney, threatening the Joint Chiefs is not the answer! I never should have taught you to use your goddamn computer!" comes the answering cry from inside. "You might be able to be casual about your career, but I can't!" "It's only a little court-martial," John yells back, and seeing Jack and Henry standing in the upstairs hall, he says, "Oh, thank God. Can somebody please get this door open before Rodney starts screaming bloody hell at all three branches of the armed forces?" The dramatics continue. "Rodney, I swear to God!" And, "It wasn't your fault. You shouldn't get blamed!" While Henry starts working at the door, an activity that only seems to bore him for a second, before he says, "Okay, so I'm starting to see why a strapping young man like yourself didn't just kick this down." "Goddamn magnets," John says bitterly, eyes starting to cross. "McKay, come on! You're just going to make this worse!" Meanwhile, feeling extremely useless, Jack settles in, leaning against the wall next to the woman from before, her expression increasingly anxious. "So," he says awkwardly, "were you the one who put in the call?" She turns and smiles at him tightly. "Yes, thank you for coming so quickly." "Jack Carter, Sheriff," Jack introduces himself. "Taylor Imagen, I'm a friend of John and Rodney's," she answers tiredly. "I've never seen you around Eureka before." He would have remembered. Without the hazy worry of John actually carrying out the 419, Jack realizes she's really hot. "No, I'm not from here," Taylor explains. "My people, the Athodians, live on the Atlantean homeworld, where Colonel Shepard and Dr. McKay are normally stationed. I'm here for the winter solstice." Before Jack can freak out about things like "my people" and "homeworld" and "stationed," he hears a high-pitched shriek from inside the room, McKay shouting, "Back! Back, you Yeti!" just as Henry finally jimmies open the door. And when they all burst in, it's to see an admittedly Yeti-like man holding McKay's cell phone. An incredibly complicated number that looks nothing like any cell phone Jack has ever seen. About 3 feet over his head, and Rodney shoving uselessly at him. "Give it back!" Rodney snarls. "Just wait until I get back to a place where I can program your life into a living hell." The man just bares his teeth at him. "I can take anything you can dish out." "Okay," John says, rushing up to step between Rodney and the man mountain. "Nobody's making anybody take anything." "You and me, Ronan," Rodney growls, glaring. "You and me, I'm about to throw it down." "Try me," Ronan growls back, grinning. "Ronan, unless you want to get shocked every time you try to take a piss, I suggest you quit now, while you're ahead," John snaps. And Rodney, the man just climbed up the side of his three-story house with his bare hands and punched out a window. "You're not taking him down." "Jesus!" He turns around and winces, saying to Jack, "Sorry about that, but could you and Henry go down to the basement? There are a couple of high-level government employees. Rodney locked in with the rats." While Henry struggles with an even more powerful set of magnetic locks on the basement door, Jack and Taylor talk at the kitchen table. Ronan is eating his way steadily through the refrigerator, and upstairs the sound of a low-pitched, furious argument can be heard.
"It is a complicated story," Taylor says, shaking her head and sighing, "but suffice it to say that our missions meet frequently with unexpected dangers, and while Colonel Shepard is a very good and conscientious leader, he cannot predict every possibility."
"She means McKay wandered off,"
Ronan supplies before shoving a handful of cheese nibs in his mouth.
"Wait, wait. He got that banged up from getting lost?" Jack says skeptically.
Taylor winces. "No, what Ronan means is that Dr. McKay was pursuing some unique energy signatures on a world we were visiting and unknowingly was separated from his military escort." Her mouth hardens. "His captors were not kind. He was in the infirmary for many weeks before he was well enough to take his requested sabbatical.
Jack winces. He remembers in a sudden flash what McKay looked like that first time, and wonders how bad it must have been before the many weeks in the infirmary, and thinks he doesn't want to know what McKay and Shepherd do, if this is what it does to them.
But you negotiated for his release, Jack asks uncomfortably.
Not exactly, Taylor prevaricates. Abandoning the cheese nibs, Ronan goes for the frosted mini-wheats, and between handfuls he says conversationally,
Shepherd blew up some continents.
At Jack's blankly horrified expression, he adds,
they were probably uninhabited.
It's right about then that the rest of the interested parties pour into the room, a flustered and angry-looking crowd of men in dark suits and Air Force dress uniforms, shoulders slumping under their stars and medals. They all look ferociously angry and incredibly embarrassed, and Ronan smirks at them from his spot deep inside the pantry.
Where's Colonel Shepherd?
One of them, bald and with round glasses, tie askew, bites out, fists shaking. He's upstairs, Taylor says soothingly, rising in one smooth, unbreaking line from her seat. I will retrieve him for you. She pauses in front of them, and in that same hypnotically calm voice says, I hope you do not hold Dr. McKay's actions against him. Dr. Beckett said that some of the medications might make him behave in a way that is out of character. Henry, dropping down into the empty seat alongside Jack, as the dark and angry crowd moves out of the room, says,
Wow, I really thought everybody was exaggerating about these two.
No, Jack says evenly.
You should have seen the fit Shepherd pitched when we found out they were torturing McKay for intel,
Ronan mumbles, investigating a can of Chef Boyardee ravioli.
It makes this look like amateur hour.
Henry raises his eyebrow. He blew up some continents, Jack offers, but Ronan says they were probably uninhabited.
I see, Henry says strangely, and offers to show Ronan the can opener.
Zoe grills Jack when he gets home, and then proceeds to go on in half-hour tear about the gross discrimination inherent in don't ask, don't tell. Don't harass, don't pursue too, Dad. Jeez, don't you know anything? Before Jack goes and says,
Actually, I think they're mad about something else.
She stops short, in the middle of a prepositional phrase, does a mental U-turn and asks, Like what?
Like John blew up some continents, Jack says, and adds reassuringly, on another planet.
Zoe makes a conflicted expression.
Well, she says after a beat, I'm sure he had a good reason.
Jack points at her. This town is turning us into freaks, Zoe. Total freaks. Jack's pretty sure that his perspective from the outside spares him a lot of anguish and drama. But the next time he sees the McKay clan, it seems the worst of it has blown over. John and McKay and Ronan and Taylor are standing in the only tree lot in Eureka, hydroponic Douglas firs, and snapping at one another over which one to take home. McKay says,
Beauty is symmetry. Clearly, the first one we saw was the most mathematically symmetrical of this lot, and somebody else who is not a blind freak is going to take it before we can, if you keep this up.
John argues, But beauty isn't character.
That tree was boring. This one,
he's indicating one that Jack can only describe as slightly lame, has character. It is listing to the right, Taylor says oddly. Will that not hinder the process of hanging glass bolts off of it?
I don't get it. There are trees around your house, Ronan complains.
McKay puts his face in his hands.
This was the worst idea ever,
he says, muffled through his gloves and scarf and enormous coat.
Let's bring the aliens home for the holiday, Rodney. They'll like it. We can hang lights, Rodney. It'll be cool. It'll be a nice break for you, Rodney. Just go with it. Do it, or I'm cutting you off for a year.
Be nice to me, John pouts. I was close to getting busted back down to a major.
Close only counts in horseshoe, hand grenades, and sign team pools, Rodney snaps, and then his expression softens, the same way it must have when he was jamming John's streusel rolls down the garbage disposal in paranoid caring.
But you didn't, and that's the important thing.
because the gold oak leaf was lame.
I believe we should acquire this one, Taylor calls out. She's standing next to a manicured bush, shaped to be a perfect sphere, and staring at it in curious wonder. Jack shakes his head, but figures that he should take his opportunities where they come, and he sneaks into the tree lot and sneaks off with McKay's perfectly symmetrical tree, before the quartet stops squabbling about whether or not a bush can be used as a Christmas tree.
It is a tree, Taylor says defensively, enamored. Just a small, round tree.
And notices that Jack's tying it to the rooftop of his SUV. He'll probably get hell for it later, but right now, Jack is thinking about going home and harassing Zoe into helping him make strings of popcorn and ornaments out of folded newspaper stars, cranes made out of Sports Illustrated pages. His ex got the house and the stuff and all of the memories, but Jack is invested in making new ones. And later that night, Zoe is hiding her sniffles badly at their 98,237,439,847th watching of It's a Wonderful Life, and her insistence that the next thing on their holiday movie queue should be something less sappy, like Bring It On. Jack thinks that he doesn't miss his house, or his stuff, or any of the memories he had to give up and put away, or even the ones that never really existed, of Allison and a white mailbox, a baby that never happened. Because despite everything else, he has this. He has Zoe, he has this perfectly symmetrical Christmas tree, and somewhere in Eureka, John is putting one up that lists to the left, while McKay sputters in fury, and Ronan eats them out of house and home, and everything is utterly perfect. They leave quietly as spring is creeping back into the town, taking off in their green SUV with a few suitcases and a hug and a careful squeeze from Zoe to McKay, who suffers it with a sort of battered grace. The McKay that leaves is bouncing on his balls off his feet, cast free and snapping at everybody, the opposite of quiet, a whirlwind of complaining and bitching and theatrics that makes Jack tired just watching him. But John seems to drink it all in, with an indulgent sort of happiness. Wary but glad. Sorry to have left without saying a word, John apologizes. His voice is staticky, but I'm on kind of a short leash at work, and when they say jump, I say, how high, sir?
Not a problem. Next time,
Jack tells him, come to town under better circumstances. John laughs over the phone, and in the background, Jack can hear Rodney saying,
no, no, you utterly fools! What the hell makes you think that something 40 feet wide was going to fit through something with a diameter of 20? I knew a blonde 16-year-old who was better at basic arithmetic than that.
I'm pretty sure we won't be dealing with any repeat offenders, John says, too casually. And Jack makes a decision not to think about what John's like when he's not losing fights with crockery and letting McKay make him invisible helicopters. Look, we're about to head out. Say hi to Zoe for me. And McKay sends his best.
I'm sure he does, Jack says, and they hang up.
To be totally honest, Jack's not really sure he'd like Lieutenant Colonel Shepherd, but he likes John just fine, and that's compartmentalization he can handle. So Jack gets Sarah to fix him an open-faced turkey sandwich and pull up the Michigan game, settles in on his couch, and waits for Zoe to get home. It's Friday, and TNT is probably running Bring It On. Again. The end.